Welcome to the Wide World of Punting, Season 2, our in-depth episodes. This is Episode 7, first one of 2022. So Happy New Year, and thanks for all the positive response I've had for the 12 Punting Commandments, which was the last show a couple of weeks ago, just before Christmas. People really enjoyed that. And if you didn't catch that one yet, that's one I highly recommend. I'm really proud of putting that one together and really believe that's an hour's worth of knowledge that truly can help you and go a long way to making your 2022 successful on the punt. Now, in terms of this season, there's going to be maybe only one more episode and up to a maximum of three more episodes in the next 3 weeks. And that's purely dependent on me locking down a couple of guests that have been elusive. That would be great shows if I can make it happen, but some things are not in my control. I'll do my best. But for this week, we've got an awesome chat. Now, my original interview that I couldn't secure has opened up this opportunity for me to bring up a conversation that was actually recorded in April 2020. So it's a bit like my chat with Dan Smith, the former bookie trader, that was also recorded 2 years ago now. This is with Lukey Mack on making a living being a pro punter on Betfair. So if you're familiar with Luke and you recognize him or you recognize his voice, I also brought him on to an episode of Wide World of Punting right about a year ago. He was on episode 10. And that was specifically looking at cricket punting and edges that he tries to exercise and activities day-to-day of a full-time punter. That's not what I'm repeating. So we got him on a year ago because heaps of people really enjoyed the original chat and then wanted to hear more from him. But this is the footage or the conversation that will be on this week's episode. It has not been on Wild World of Punting before, has not been on YouTube. It was played on the Facebook page. So hopefully you'll enjoy it. If you never caught that one, you might really enjoy this one. Or if you haven't followed the tripod that far back. Tristan's got the week off. The only other part of this pod will be the Wide World Bet of the Week. And I should mention, we saluted the 13-1 random AF multi shared in episode 1. If you rode that with me, we've won all the legs, except of course the leg that voided, which was the juiciest leg. So it's a $5 dividend that's paid out as a winner, getting that push. I'll always maintain I had a great pick on that fifth boxing leg, and it should have paid us 13-1 if that guy didn't withdraw, but that's how it went. Happy to kick off with a winner in the account for 2022, and I really like my tip for this week that I'll share at the end. But now, my interview with Lukey. Again, we're in the midst of the summer of cricket, and we talk a lot about how Lukey's made a living punting on cricket and live trading cricket. He also talks NRL, which he loves, and racing, which he doesn't necessarily love, but he had a lot of experience live trading that. And if anybody, even if those sports or racing doesn't appeal, like anybody who's interested at all in Betfair and how it works, Lukey explains a lot of that, as well as just the mindset of a pro punter, which I think people always find really interesting, just hearing from somebody who punts professionally, because it's a dream to a lot of people. And he talks about some really good advice that you could take if you ever wanted to start out, but also mistakes he made along the way. And there's an all-timer in there. There's a story he's going to tell of having $6,000 on a $1 shot, but I'll let him share that one later in the show. Enjoy. We're going to chat Betfair, your experiences, good and bad with it, but definitely methods that you've been able to use to make a profit. Let's start with just explaining maybe how you got into it and how you transitioned from just using it to deciding, you know, you could make it a full-time venture.
Yeah, it's a pretty sort of standard way to come across, I guess, in that, I fell into sort of Betfair anyway, but I fell into it in a pretty standard way, which was through bonus bagging. So that's the old, you know, get a bonus bet from the bookmaker, back it somewhere and lay it back on Betfair. And at the time, I was playing poker full-time professionally and just a mate at the table said, have you ever heard of doing this? And I hadn't. And he just said, oh, I'm making a fair bit extra coin on the weekends, just on a Saturday, you know, and I was like, okay, you know, had a look at it. And that sort of was really my introduction to Betfair. But pretty quickly, you work out that just doesn't have any longevity in it. Obviously, the bookmakers, you know, going to crack down on that and ban bonus bets for your accounts and those sorts of things. And you run out of family and friends that also are able to do it. So yeah, I just but I really like the concept of Betfair. And look, I can't really tell you exactly how I found sort of the trading side of it, but I just ended up, you know, on some sites like Carnberry was one of the first sites that I went on, who's a UK trader. Peter Webb, who started Bet Angel and also trades, and just started reading through. And then you just end up finding other people that have maybe written blogs or things like that, and started reading about those. And just sort of jumped into it. Like most things, I sort of jumped in way too early. I didn't really know what I was doing. I was trying to do UK racing. So I would start really late at night and try and work through the night. And that was primarily because Carnberry, those guys, they were all doing UK racing. And so if I was going to try and learn, I wanted to try and be in the same markets that they were in. But, you know, I didn't know anything about racing. I didn't know anything about UK racing, especially. So it was a really tough gig. And I think I dusted maybe a grand in the first week. And I was like, oh, no, this is not good. You know, like I'm out of my depth. And then from there, I can't really tell you how I sort of transitioned into sport, but I just found that there was, you know, other things that I could be doing. And then having played a whole bunch of cricket, watched, you know, more cricket than any human probably should growing up, I realised that cricket actually had really big pools on Betfair, and, you know, I started to sort of migrate towards that. But even in that interim, I still, you know, I tried to trade anything that moved once I found sport. You know, I remember doing darts, and I honestly didn't even know the rules of darts, you know, like I was trying to trade it. I just, anything that moved, I wanted to trade it. But really specialising was where I started to get some success, and that was in cricket, and then after that in rugby league as well.
Let's start with cricket. I know you mentioned the gold rush of the match betting era, where, as you say, all the bookies were fighting for market share. You could get massive, you know, bonus bets with bookies, and I know there was huge opportunities there. It's kind of dried out, sadly, for a lot of people. And you mentioned racing, which we're going to circle back to as well. But hey, it's a good place to start anywhere is cricket. So can you talk through your process? I also have a question about it in general. I think a lot of us have an understanding that you can get really good odds, or maybe better odds most of the time, on Betfair than you can just typically in a similar market on a bookmaker. But the question that has come up a lot is, you know, are there decent enough limits for people who like to put down bigger bets, especially if you're trying to, you know, do it professionally?
Yeah, I mean, for the sports that have the huge pools, so, you know, cricket, tennis, golf, I'm sure I'm missing a couple there, but soccer, you know, like there's certain sports on there that have massive pools, and there'd be no listener that's listening that couldn't get whatever they wanted on. And much like a bookmaker, the closer that you bet, well, a good bookmaker anyway, the closer that you bet to the off, the more money that there will be in the pool. You know, no one's really going to stick their neck out, you know, a week before a game and have these huge amounts sitting on the other side. Because with Betfair, obviously the listeners that aren't familiar, they need to understand that it's an exchange, you know. So if I'm betting on one side, you've got somebody else that's taking the bet equal and opposite on the other side. And the best way to sort of get your head around it can be a bit hard at the start, but the best way to get your head around it is, say you own 1,000 BHP shares and you want to sell them, you can't just sell them without a buyer on the other side. And the same back the other way. If you want to be a buyer of BHP, you actually need someone in the market putting 1,000 shares in there. So the same thing happens with Betfair. If you want to back a team, if you want to buy a side, you actually need someone on the other side selling them. But the pools are massive, and particularly as you get closer to the off. And like I said, you know, people are going to be more inclined to have bigger amounts of liquidity sitting in the market for you to take as it gets closer to the start of the game, because so much more information is out about that game. Teams have been listed and whatever, what have you. So, people will not struggle to get a bet on. And especially if they're prepared to sort of wait until you know, day of and those sorts of things of the actual event.
Well, that's good to know. That definitely presents another opportunity for people who haven't, you know, gotten into Betfair and they are looking to put big bets on. If we look at how you might attack a cricket match then, and you can decide, like, to give an example, maybe whether it be a test match or, you know, a limited overs match. Can you talk through your process that, you know, this match is coming up, you're looking at it. What are you analysing before the game in terms of, are you trying to see which team, you know, might hold an edge, or you're starting to think about how the match will unfold? And then, like, is it as simple as betting one side or the other, or a draw, or are there markets, you know, derivative markets within just the actual result? And of course, your process once the first ball is bowled, because I know that people have asked, and you've told me before we started, that plenty of the trading is actually done live, you know, during the event that you're betting on.
Yeah, there's a lot of what I do is in play. I'll start with the first part with, you know, I guess sort of a bit of the process. I don't do an awful lot of study, which people would probably be surprised about. I do go and have a look at some of the, you know, maybe the average scores at that ground that's coming up, you know, some of those sort of details. But I watch a lot of cricket. You know, there wouldn't be many games that I don't watch. And so I'm relying more on that than anything. I think one thing that sort of gets left behind a lot in the stats and things with cricket is probably form, and I think it really does play quite a big role, or a bigger role than maybe what most people think. So I don't do a lot of study before the game. I do have friends that do that are quite successful, that do a lot of study, yeah, it's just sort of, there's different ways to skin the cat, I guess, so to speak. So whatever sort of gets you to the Holy Grail, there's many different ways to do it. For the people that are maybe interested in doing something with cricket or with Betfair, I would suggest starting out with Test cricket. The reason being is just the markets move so much more slowly, and you have so much more time to react to what's happening with the position that you have in the market. You know, basically, the things that are going to move the market in cricket are all your major events. So obviously, runs, they're not super. You know, they happen quite frequently. They're not an infrequent thing, but they do still move the market. But you know, obviously, wickets, an injury can as well. But with Test cricket, it's a little bit different to the shorter form stuff, because runs aren't actually as valuable, and you'll see that if you just sit down and just watch the charts for a little while. And when I say the charts, it's really important that if you want to, you know, have a crack at this, that you get some sort of software. I personally use Geek's Toy, but there's BetAngel, there's Racing Trader, there's a whole bunch of them, and there's just a whole bunch of reasons why you really need it, in my opinion anyway. But just being able to sit there and actually watch, you know, the way that it sets up with ladders and with charts, you can just get a nice feel for the flow and the betting movements throughout the match. And you'll, if you sit there and watch, you know, you can see a team sort of put on 50 or 60 runs, you know, without a wicket, and the market's really not doing that much. Whereas if that happens in a short form game, that's going to have an effect on the market. Sometimes in Test cricket, runs aren't actually that important. It's the wickets that are the key moments. So, but yeah, if people are keen, definitely start out with Test cricket. You've got a lot more time to react to what's happening in the market. And just one piece of advice is that I would think with Test cricket, if you do have a crack at it, and I'm sure you'll quickly move into short form. If you're thinking about a really good trader taught me this, and I think it's a great way to think about trading cricket, is to if you're trading Test cricket, sort of think session length with your bet. The big problem that people have when they come across from sort of traditional sports betting is they can't get their head around the idea of forgetting about who wins. It's really irrelevant. That's the outcome. The process for you is to think about what's going to happen in the market, what's going to happen in the game that's going to affect the market, and how you can make money either on the up or down swing of that market. So, you know, with Test cricket, think session length for your bets or for your trades. And as it gets shorter, so one day cricket, maybe think 10 over blocks. And for short form stuff, super short form stuff in T10 and T20, you know, you're thinking like 6 to 9 balls, you know, and that's probably one piece of advice that I was given to me by a trader who has taught me a lot about it. And that is to think in those three things when I'm trading those three specific formats.
Would that be in the sense of where do you think the game is going to be at the end of that block and trying to get a position now based on that?
Exactly, yeah. Because like, say with T20, every ball is an event, right? Like every single ball that gets bowled is an event. It could go for 6 or it could take a wicket, and they are huge, you know, swings in the game or anything in between. In Test cricket, someone can hit a 6 and it really, you know, it might not do that much to the market. So, whereas if they bat a session and don't lose a wicket and put on 90 runs, that's going to make the market react. And it won't just sort of wait for, you know, 26, 27 overs and then just drop. It's going to be moving gradually throughout the session. But, yeah, it's just it's important to realise that in the really short form stuff, one bowler coming on and bowling that one over, I mean, just a bowler coming on can actually move the market. You know, the number one bowler in the world in T20s, when Rashid Khan comes on, you can actually see the market move before he bowls a ball, you know, because the market's already pricing in that he won't go for many runs or that he will take a wicket. So, yeah, exactly as you said, you know, really small stuff. You're just thinking about that small block, 6 to 9 balls, say, and what's going to happen in that 6 to 9 balls. 50 over stuff, sort of 10 overs, and what's going to happen in that 10 over block, and then with your Test cricket session length stuff. Yeah,
so it definitely sounds like you're applying your, you know, the way that you can read and feel a game, because you know each little incident or each event in that game, how important it is. But, and also I appreciate you sharing the software tools, because people did ask about that, and I was very naive when people said, can you ask some questions about what software Luke would recommend. I didn't even realize people using software, but you've kind of explained it's a tool to help you, I guess, filter information that's coming through or process it more efficiently and more clearly. I'm still just trying to get my head around like what your process would be to profit though. Like, are you saying that you're not betting on who's going to win in that live bet? It's a bet more like on a, I don't know, a team run total or next wicket to fall? Or could you give examples of actual trades you'd make?
I do actually bet on run lines as well, which is, you know, how many runs a team may score. But no, it's you always have an eye to who you think's going to win. But some of my worst results have come when I've come in with this big predetermined idea that this side's going to smash this side, you know, and you end up so deep on that side so early that you've got no more room to trade anymore, you know. And so I would say coming in with that fresh sort of perspective on the game is where I've had my best results. And, yeah, I do have an eye to who I think will win, but I'm generally not thinking about that thoroughly until, we're talking Test cricket here, I'm not thinking about that until, you know, sort of end of day three, day four, and obviously day five. You know, at the start, there's just so much cricket to be played, you know, like, 90 overs a day for 5 days, like there's just tons of cricket to be played. So thinking about the winner is really difficult. And like I said, it's had some of my worst results. So, yeah, I'm more thinking about how I think things are going to unfold. And that might be as simple as, righto, so the first three bats in this side, I really rate them. You know, I consider these three their best bat, but, you know, they're going to be up against two bowlers that I consider really good, but then after that, it's just utter filth, you know. So in that instance, that matchup, I like the matchup, but if I could maybe get on at the back end of the bowler's opening spell, that might be the spot if they've still got wickets intact. So it's like thinking about how things might play out in the game. Whereas if they're three down and the opening bowlers are coming to the back end of their spell, I might need to wait and see whether sort of, you know, that's 4, 5 and 6 can get in and sort of offer something. So, yeah, it's sort of thinking about matchups and strategy within the game. And I guess that was what specialising showed me, was that I have a very deep understanding of two sports, and it's important to focus on them. And I love them. I love to watch them. I mean, I have lost a little bit of sort of just watching it to watch it. I do watch it and think about edges and ways that I can make money from it, which is a bit sad. Like, but you know, I did go to the Women's World Cup final. I was able to just, you know, enjoy that for what it was. I actually went there and just enjoyed it. But it is important to really focus on something like that you love and something that you know really well. And that's why some of my friends, I can't understand how they get into racing. You know, my most recent efforts in racing actually were profitable. I was able to turn about $6,500 in, I think, about 8 or 9 weeks of profit. And a lot of people, it was like pulling teeth. You know, I just don't enjoy it. I could sit there and I could watch Test cricket day on day on day on day. I could watch rugby league all day, you know, give me old replays, whatever. I don't care. Love them both, but I just can't get into racing. And although I think I could actually make a quid from it, it's just not for me, you know. It's just not my sport. It's not something that I enjoy. I don't care to learn about, like, gear changes and whatever else that there is in it. But for the listeners out there that do understand and love that stuff, you can focus on.
It's funny because there probably are people listening who love racing and, like, would never sit and watch an entire test match start to finish. But just to finish up on cricket, I mean, if you can share any other, like, insights you've had with cricket or what your biggest successful form of the game is, but a general question about trading sport, just your philosophy, I'm trying to understand, are you looking to kind of arb games and get a good price on both sides, or is it more just about each individual trade is a good value trade, whether that may be that you're on a number of outcomes that may all be lopsided?
To give you an idea, there was a test match, I think it was India, Australia, summer here, so it must be a couple of years ago now. They beat us 2-1, I think. I think I had 1,000 bets in one of those test matches, whereas in other games I could have one bet and hold it all the way through and have a red on the other side. So there's no hard and fast rule of, like, oh, okay, you know, take a position of $1,000 on this team at evens, and when it goes to $1.90, I hedge off and I've got a green book across the... It's something that, like, you just sometimes you bet and you hold it, and sometimes, you know, you might be just looking for some little moves. And there's a whole bunch of theories that I use to sort of make up my end book. I would say to people, one piece of advice that I give to a lot of people that ask me about this stuff is if you're greening up too much, and that means if you're hedging up your book too much, that's not a bad leak to have. You know, I would prefer to see newbies greening up more often than not, rather than holding and getting themselves in deep positions. And that's something that you need to build up a bit of a risk tolerance, build up a bit of a stomach for that sort of stuff to hold, you know, maybe backing really short prices and holding them all the way through. That can be real gut-wrenching for a lot of people. So, you know, for me, like, I would start people out by trying to find low prices to lay, so low prices to oppose, bigger prices to back, and just smaller, because you can play with smaller amounts at that amount, and then trying to find positions where you think that you'll green up. And the entries are often easier for most people. I always find that, you know, when I talk to people about this that are starting out, they always say, I'm really enjoying this. I'm finding it easy to back a team, you know, maybe at $3 or something. And then it comes in and I just want to hold it, though. You know, I just want to hold it. I just want to – and they've come from just punting, where they back something and they hold it all the way through. The exit is the hardest part, I would say, of the whole process. And for me, basically, the exit – I could try to simplify it by saying that you only want to exit something when something has fundamentally changed in whatever the thesis that you've made on that particular entry. So, you know, you back a side because the new ball's about to come. For instance, they're bowling and they're about to get the new ball, and it's been a test match that in the previous three innings you've seen that the new ball has taken a lot of wickets. You think, you know what, I'm going to back this side at $3. you know, for some reason they don't start with the new ball bowler that you would assume that they start with or something like that, that could be a reason for you to exit a trade straight away. You know, you just nip it right there. You might get out for a small loss at 310 or 320 or something like that because the market sees it as well. But something's fundamentally changed. You thought new ball bowler, they're going to come on with Stark and Cummins or something, and they come on with, you know, someone else, and you think, yeah, it's not who I envisaged them bowling, and so you might get out of that trade. So, you know, you need a plan. You need a plan for your entry, and then your exit is really like when something has fundamentally changed to why you made that entry. So that's how I just sort of try to process, get people to process their exit, and that's often the hardest part.
And to clarify, when you say greening up, right, would that be, that means that you've got bets at certain prices that no matter whether the game ends, Australia, India, victorious or a draw, you've made a profit because of the positions you took at the right time.
Exactly. So like the easiest way to get your head around this is, say there's only two results, not a test match, there's two sides. I back one side at $3, I have 100 on them, right? I'm now going to profit 200 or lose 100. But then they start going really well. The other team equally and opposite drifts at that point. They go out to $3, the other team into 150. I have 100 on them. Now I profit $100 no matter who wins the game. So that's greening up. There's also redding up. I wouldn't let people, you know, they need to understand that there's also the other side of it. And it's certainly not an easy game. You know, and that can be, you know, you're back at $1.50 and then they start going really poorly. The other team's into $1.50 now, and then you have 100 there and you've got a guaranteed loss across both sides. So that can happen as well.
And you hear that's what I actually want to ask you about. Yeah, like the perfect example is get on an underdog at good odds and then they, you know, start really well. And now you're in a position of power, obviously. So you jump on the other team, you're going to get better odds than they started. Or if you kind of keep riding the wave of the underdog. But in the other scenario, you get on the $3 underdog and they start poor. Then, like, are you trying to read the game to decide, oh, like, I've just got this wrong. I need to get on this favorite now and cut my losses, so to speak. Because at that point, obviously, yeah, you're either going to lose unless the underdog turns the game around.
Yeah. So I guess, like, with that, you'll hear a lot of, where a lot of people start when they want to get into sports trading is because there's not a lot of, I guess, video and literature about it specifically. You'll end up looking into a lot of trading books, you know, financial trading and those sorts of things. And a lot of, one thing that you'll commonly read is the line, let your winners run and cut your losses short, you know, which essentially means when things are going well, let it run its course. And when it's going, poorly, quickly nip it in the bud. Now, it took me a long while to sort of get my head around how that worked. And it seems so easy in theory, but like it's just not so easy in practice to actually do that. And for me, what I prefer to do is when I make a decision, I prefer to sort of block my entry in or stagger my entry into a particular position. So that way, if it is going against me, I've got a chance to take another position at another stage in the game. So, you know, for ease of purposes of numbers, let's say, you know, someone's got a bank of $1,000, you know, I wouldn't want to be getting into a position of red on any side more than 5% of my bankroll. And 5% of my bankroll would be something that I consider to be a red hot position. And most of my positions are sort of 0.5% or 1%. I'm a bit of a what they call bankroll net. Like I'm pretty tight with my bankroll and the way that I sort of maneuver the numbers, and I really don't sort of go too much outside that. I know other guys that have taken big shots and been able to, you know, run their bank up really big, really quickly. But I think in the end, the best way, in my opinion, to go is to have 5% sort of as a cap. And so if, let's say I back, you know, an underdog, like you said, at $3, I might start that position with just a $10 trade. At $3, you know, with a $1,000 bank, so I'm in for me 1%, and then it starts to go against me. But I still like the way the match is going, or the way that the game is going. You know, it's been a you know, a kick from a try or something like that. But I think it's been a real sort of ding dong battle. Or, you know, the guy just got an absolute peach. You know, would have got anybody out, but it looks pretty flat out there. You know, other than that on the wicket, you know, I might top up then. You know, and have another 10 at whatever the price is after that major event that's happened, being a wicket or a try against. So definitely give yourself what I like to call more bullets in the gun. You know, if you find that you're pulling the trigger and it's making a clicking sound, you know, that can be a problem. You know, leave the bullets in the gun. It's important to have them because you just don't know. The variance can come in the match. These are people playing a game, or, you know, their horses running a race. And so, you know, things can go against you. So, you know, leave some bullets in the gun so that you can top up. And finding then what you're going to find, the next natural progression from there is people are going to start topping up. But it's like, I feel like sometimes when I top up, they're some of the biggest losses that I had when I first started out. And that was because I would top up too big. So, you know, get your bankroll, whatever that is, know what your 5% max is. And if I take a 1%er and things go against me, I might just be like, just hold it and leave it, because this position was only ever worth 1% of my bankroll. But if I feel like it was a really big price and now they've blown out again to a bigger price and I still think that that's value, you know, that's when I'm sort of topping up again. So it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of screen time and intuition for people to be able to understand what is value and what is not value. But it just takes time to sort of get your head around what that is. I can't really sort of explain that. It's just something that comes with sitting and watching the screens.
Yeah, different people are different. Like, some people are completely mathematical, but I've always talked about it being an art and a science. Like, there's some math involved, but as you talk about, you know, a real understanding and experience and knowledge of the game, you can feel it. If you did refer to a couple of, you know, footy analogy. So if we move to rugby league and your process there, I'm curious as well. So if you're not always trying to green up then, in the sense that if you get on a team, and whether it be a pretty even tussle of footy where both sides are, you know, close to even money, you jump on a team and they score two or three quick tries, are you at that point just thinking, well, now I get a nice juicy price on the side that's down? Or would that be one you just want to ride it through because now the team that you picked is kind of clearly getting on top?
Yeah, it's there's no hard and fast rule with it, obviously. It's sort of there's quite a few factors that could be at play. Things like weather, for instance, could come during a game, and that could totally change you know, how I feel about a particular game. But there's no real hard and fast rule. But I guess what I'm in all of my trading, one of the big things that I'm looking for is overreactions. And overreactions happen in the market all the time, everywhere, for pretty much most sports, and especially the ones that I trade. So if you can keep an eye out while you're watching the ladders and you're watching the game, you can start to pick up where the market is overreacting. And that can happen for a whole variety of reasons, but you might have someone who's taken a massive position in a game and it starts going against them, and they just start panicking and they just want to liquidate their position at any price. They really don't care. So in that instance that you spoke about, there might be someone that has had, you know, 40, 50, 100 grand on a side, and now they're down three tries at halftime. And you can see the money come into the market where they're just like, I just want to get out of this. I just, at any price. And so they might put a brick in and, you know, 75,000 bit gets matched, but not enough. They move down. And at some point that becomes an overreaction, in my opinion. And I'll start to lay that back, you know. So, yeah, overreactions is what I'm looking for. That's a little bit different to pre-game, but that still does happen too. You might see a player get named as an injury or is going to, you know, going to be out for some other reason. Massive overreaction, in my opinion. The market way overrates that player or underrates a player potentially. So overreaction or underreaction is sort of where the most of the money is made, in my opinion. And that's what you're really looking for. Essentially what we're doing is trying to find prices that, in our opinion, are wrong. And you don't really have anything hard and fast to compare it to, apart from over, say, you know, a few months or half a year or a year, if you're able to consistently turn a profit, you can start to see that you're able to pick off those spots that are value. So I try to explain it to people that your entry and your exit are both bets. Now, the best result that you could hope for would be to make a plus EV, so have a positive expectation on your entry and a positive expectation on your exit. That's the best possible scenario. The worst, obviously, being, you know, negative EV on the entry, negative EV on the exit. And then there's anything in between. And even EV, where it just has you back something at $2 and its actual price was $2, that's okay too. If you can get a positive entry and an even EV sort of exit, that can be okay as well. Overreactions is things that people need to focus on. And the best way to be able to identify those overreactions is literally just get yourself some software, have it loaded up with the games and the market open, the TV's on, and you just sit there and you just got to spend some time watching the screen. But those people that have a good understanding of sports and what the true value of that person's wicket may be, or what the true value of that person injuring themselves and not coming out for the second half, or people that have a real understanding of what that actually means in the full context of the game are going to be able to pick off the overreactions in the market.
So to make a plus EV bet, you've really in your mind got to roughly know the win percentage on each side of, you know, in a head-to-head game, at least what you think it is. You think at a point in time a team's 75% to 25%, something like that. You said it's hard to compare, but I would imagine is a good resource looking at the live odds on all the corporate bookmakers, because at that, you know, during a game you can see what the prices they're offering, and you might be able to compare that to, as you say, someone panic selling on a team and you might get way overs. It doesn't prove it's great value, but at least you know it's a lot more than any live bet you could put down.
Yeah, I guess the biggest problem you've got with that is the books really follow Betfair. Betfair is your primary market in play. If it's got big liquidity, then and which cricket absolutely does, and rugby league, it still follows it pretty well. But occasionally you do get a bit of separation, and it can be. It can be something that you could use as a tool for sure. But, you know, for me, it's mostly my opinions and my thoughts. And also I would say that it is important to get a bit of a network around you of people that also understand the game and are probably trading as well. I'm a part of a few group chats, a Discord chat, and then Twitter's probably the best resource that I came across out of everything. Twitter, out of all resources, was the place where I probably learned the most. And it's just good to sometimes bounce how you're feeling about a certain game. And sometimes people will play devil's advocate, or sometimes people will, you know, sort of back up what you're saying. And over time, one thing that I would say is tracking people's opinions on certain games or certain situations can actually be a really good indicator in the future. I'll have a few people that when they give their indication on a game, I'd be very happy to do the equal and opposite, whereas other people, if they give their opinion on the game, it gives me a shot in the arm if I'm on the same side. So, I know, one of the big traders who helped coach me a lot early on and mentor me, I know early on when I was trading, I often found that I was on the other side of his trades. Like, he would be on one side and I was on the other side. And I was like, you know, I was losing. And I quickly realized that something wasn't right in my methodology, something wasn't right in those instances. It wasn't that I was losing overall, but when I was opposed to him, I often ended up on the wrong end of the stick. So it became an indicator for me that, you know, like if I sort of put it out there and he would reply and say, you know, he was doing something else, I'd be thinking, okay, you know, I've got this wrong. And that could be a spot where I would quickly lay down and hedge my position and reassess. So
that goes to show just having good resources out there, and you can still do your own work and come up with your own tips, your own opinions. But if there's someone out there that you respect their opinions, it might not be enough for you to follow them blindly, but it might keep you off a play just because you know that person's not going to be wrong a lot. So, I mean, at worst, you're not going to have a hugely, you know, profitable return if you're fading a person that you know does really well. It definitely sounds to me like you have to have a skill set of processing a lot of information quickly, because you talk about you've got to have the game on and you're watching that. You're talking about your software and you're looking at where the numbers are going there. And then there's executing the trades themselves. And on top of that, you're talking about doing all this on a live footy game, let's say, where, you know, the ball is moving around the field. Can you just kind of talk us through the mechanics of it? Like, can you actually put a trade in while the ball is in play, or do you at least need like mini stoppages in the game, like whatever, a penalty or a scrum, just because with the conditions literally dynamic the whole time, it just sounds quite hard where you'd get in a point where you can put a trade on that somebody else matches up with you.
Yeah, I most of my footy stuff, I would say, like, you know, I gave the example of having 1,000 bets on a test. It wouldn't be anything like that for footy. I can't give you exact number, but it'd be more in the range of maybe 10 to 15 trades on a footy game. And most of them are after a key event or something like that. So a like try,
after a
an
score,
injury.
Yeah.
You know, so there are breaks, you know, considerable breaks in that game that give you the opportunity to sort of reassess your position and go from there. But you know, some of the biggest trades and some of the best trades that I've made have been in play late in games, because there are a lot of overreactions to what's happening in a tight late game. You know, a game with a lot of field goal attempts or something like that. You can see the prices can fluck insanely in that moment. So, you know, someone taking a shot from, you know, 30 out right in front with 10 seconds to go, it's you know, it's a make or break, right? Like, so, yeah, if punters are interested in having a look at the way that the market flux in those times, you get that, you start to get an understanding of what I talk about with overreactions. You know, we can have a side, I remember there was a time, I think it was the game in Adelaide.
Rooster Storm?
Storm, and I think Smith ended up kicking the field goal to win it.
Yeah, I can remember that was the craziest game ever. Yeah. Was it like 13-12 or 9-8?
Yeah, something like that.
There was weather.
And I think there was a ton of fields. I'm sure that was the game, field goal attempts. And, you know, I remember there was a price move of, you know, it went from $1.10 to $1.10 the other side because... you know, the commentator, I think Vossi's yelled out, he's got it, you know, because the crowd behind went up and it's just faded away, you know. So, you know, that's an overreaction in that instance, you know, that they thought that the game was over, but it's a 20-metre restart. And then in that time as well, you've got the market now. You've got someone who's taken a position all the way to the other side and they've got to dump that position, you know, and they want to dump it at any spot that they can. So for a trader that, you know, has some experience and time in front of the ladders, that's the prime time, you know, that volatility, we call it. And it happens in cricket as well, where the pools are massive. Sometimes you'll see just the whole ladder will just get stripped out and backed out because someone's got a bad position and they just need to dump it. So, yeah, it's just screen time. People need to spend some time in front of the ladders. They need to have the game open and just sit there and watch it, and they'll start to pick that sort of stuff up. But, yeah, to answer your question, long-windedly, my apologies, is a lot less bets in the footy, and mainly when there's key events. And I would say, you know, I'm more likely to have a bet. I probably have a bet in almost every game at halftime. You know, reassess at halftime and then sort of go from there, so...
I appreciate how candid you are and, you know, pulling back the curtain to show exactly what you're thinking about and what your processes are. That segues pretty well, like, you know, an incorrect call by a commentator actually triggering a lot of money exchanging hands, because I've heard the one, if we talk about racing, where the caller calls the wrong horse, charging down the straight, and then a heap of money gets traded on the wrong horse and things like that. So I was going to ask, how important is it to be actually watching the event live? Sounds quite obvious that it's basically a must.
Yeah, it's a must, but you know, you I think those things you just sort of I think it is very important to watch it, and I watch it all. But I would say with things like that, sometimes you're just going to get caught out, and that's just a part of it. You know, it's like you might lose in that one instance, but they're pretty good race callers, say for instance, and over the long term they're going to get it right more often than not. And so as long as your bankroll management is proper in that instance, and you don't just decide to have $1 million at the 101 or something because you think that it's won, you know, you're going to get out of it okay. I can tell you it's just a story, a bit of a war story on that. I was watching a women's Big Bash game probably a few years ago, and there was two games on at the time, and I had the tie market up, whether I thought that the match would end in a tie, because I thought it was going to be quite close, and I had some success in that market, so I always had it up just in case I thought it was going to get close. One was on the TV, it was a live broadcast before a men's Big Bash game. The other one was only on a stream. Now, I thought that I had the game on the TV's ladder up, but I had the game on the stream. Now, I watched Amy Satterthwaite hit a six to make it a tie off the last ball of the... And the prices... I thought, oh, the prices have gone too late. I missed it. I thought it was going to be close. Oh, well, no big deal. But there was $6,000 to lay at 101. And I thought, well, it's happened. Like, I've just watched it happen, you know, like, no big deal. Like, you know, pick up $60 off the ground. I mean, you know, people would pick up $60. So I have $6,000 at $1.01. Oh, when I realized that I had bet on the one that was the streamed game, like, I hadn't bet on the live game, I'd bet on the tie market for the other one. Like, I just went bright red. I started quickly going to the score of the other game. I think they needed 60 off 10 balls to make it a tie, so it was just absolutely no chance. So I basically torched $6,000 on something that I thought was it had already happened. I thought it was not a 101, I thought it was a 1000, you know. It's done, it's happened, I just watched her hit it, you know. So yeah, I guess that sort of is the flip side, that sometimes even your eyes might deceive you. And you know, other things that happen more frequently sometimes, you know, a guy will go down in the NRL who I consider a huge impact on that game, and I start smashing the other side. You know, commentators are saying, oh, you know, I can't see how he's ever going to come back. Or he gets a bit of spray, he gets up and starts running around again, you know, and oh, I've got this big position on the other side. So it is important to watch, but sometimes your eyes can deceive you. But it's not about the short-term result in that instance, that one-off, that, you know, it's about the long-term. And you know, if you get those positions right, more often than not, you know, you're still going to come out in front. So,
and sorry, not to dwell on like an absolutely brutal loss there, but again, appreciate that you're sharing warts and all. But why in that other game, why would it have been $1.01 for it to be a tie when, you know, it wasn't by no means certain to finish as a tie?
So they were laying 101. So for them, like, they were saying that it was essentially, you know, a 100 to 1 shot or more, you know, but it was actually, you know, so much more. Like, so yeah, they were laying 101. Normally the price would have been the liquidity, if there was liquidity in that market, it actually would have been a lot higher. When I backed it, it would have been 1,000 to 1 or something, but because there wasn't any money in that market, and it's not a particularly sort of liquid, you know, women's cricket isn't something where there's a whole lot of dollars that are getting traded in that, and particularly in that side market, someone just sat a lay in there just in case someone like me would come along and make a mistake.
Oh,
yeah. And
brutal. Laid a trap for you.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. They actually call it a price trap. So it is something that people can be careful. You know, even something that you sometimes see is it might be $2.80 to back a certain thing in a side market, but then to lay it, they'll have it at 282. They're missing the decimal place to lay it, and it just tries to catch people offside. So because it is a free market, there is no real sort of rules around that. You know, people can make those sort of cheat trap plays, and it is important for people to get their head around the difference between the blue and the pink side. The blue side is just like what everybody's used to. You know, you're just having a punt on something, you know, but the pink side, you're essentially playing bookmaker. And if you're laying a price at $3, you've got to pay someone out to, you know, two times whatever they have a bet with you. So it is important to get your head around the difference between the two sides and the pink and the blue. But yeah, I got done that day.
And you've reminded me something I have to ask about, right? So people look at Betfair and we take a footy game and an underdog, as you say, you might be able to back them at $2.70. And I don't know if you want to lay them close to $3, but you tell me what you typically see. But that, of course, brings in the question, commission. Can you talk about, because is the difference in those two purely the commission? And can you talk about what kind of percentage it is and how it works?
Yeah, so the thing that I like about Betfair is that it does have a commission built into the price of 5% flat for all new accounts, but you get a discount as you go along. So the more that you turn over with them, the more discount that you get off that. But one thing that I do like is it's 5% commission on the profit that you make. So if you trade, you might have a thousand on a team, you know, and they move 10%, you hedge up and you've got $100 across both sides or something like that. You're not going to pay 5% on the thousand that you placed initially. You're going to pay 5% on the 100 that you've won at the end of the game. So yeah, it's a 5% commission. But if someone's interested in just backing a side and holding it all the way through, they need to compare the bookmaker's best price that they can find when they shop around with Betfair minus 5%. So, you know, just work out what 5% is of the price that you're looking at. Just take it off and that's the price that you're actually got. And a lot of these comparison sites around these days actually take the 5% commission out. But yeah, it's 5% on all winnings that you make. So if you have a losing bet, you don't pay any commission. There are a few other exchanges. Most aren't available to us where they actually just take a commission regardless of the bet size, smaller commission, you know, maybe 1-2% flat on all bets. But I like the Betfair structure. I think it's the best and fair way forward.
Cool. So 5% on a purely 50-50 head-to-head match, is that then $1.95 on each side?
Yeah.
Basically,
yeah, correct.
If someone's offering $2. Yeah, yeah, okay, exactly. That gives you, and so obviously on a line, which every fair line should be 50-50, you could snap up $1.95, which typically does beat what most corporate bookies offer. So right there, I can see an appeal. A couple more questions about racings for people who are interested in that. So were you, again, was it pre-race or were you betting during the race, and were you ever backing runners or were you laying them? And if you lay them, was there any particular things you're looking for in which horses you choose to lay?
So, like, I think I've had 5 shots at racing. Like, and I did see it as a holy grail when I was sort of starting out, because, you know, you start at 12 midday or so, work till 5, 5.30. You can pick any 5 days of the week, although you'd probably mix in, you know, at least one of the weekend days and probably miss a Monday just due to the sheer volume. But I did see it as the holy grail, and I gave such a big sort of shot, various shots at it. Had some... six, you know, flicks of success through it, through the first, you know, 3 or 4 goes that I had at it, and then I would just blow up the account. You know, it would just be one big blow up, and mentally I'd come undone, and, you know, I'd be on the chase, and I'd be done, you know. So I could have 5 or 6 profitable days in a row and then blow it all up and give it all back and maybe a little bit more on the 7th day or something. But in the most recent effort that I had at it, where I think, as I mentioned, I was able to sort of get 6 or 7 thousand, I think, out of it in you know, 8 or 9 weeks or something like that. It was a bunch of different sort of theories that I used, but I guess, like, again, you've got to try and find your spot in the market, because you've got people, you've got all sorts of participants in the market. You've got obviously people that are, you know, big pro syndicates that are betting sort of pre-race, that are pushing the markets around. You've got, you know, you know, a bunch of bookmakers that might be trying to hedge back positions on Betfair, or you know, sort of get out of, you know, lay a little bit of their liability potentially off. So there's all sorts of different participants in the market, and if you're sort of trying to just trade the moves and the flows of the market, you sort of got to find where you're going to fit in and start making money, because you know, the fact is that if you're making money, somebody else is losing, like on that trade. You know, like for you to get in and make your thousand a week, you need to find your spot in there, your little nestle where you're going to start, you know, taking that thousand off whatever other participant that it is. For me, I couldn't find anything pre-race really. Found a few things, you know, sometimes if you could see before a race caller, maybe he'd mentioned that a horse had sweated up or something, and then he mentioned that it was getting towed down and it sweat up, or it was fractious in the barriers or something like that. You know, you could quickly make a few ticks if you laid the horse and then backed it back as it moved out. But for me, like, my real successes always were in play. That's where I made the most of the money. And you know, some of the most basic things that I was able to, you know, still make money of, even though it was very widely accepted and widely known, was backing things that were in front and laying things that were out the back and struggling, you know, like, and it was still profitable, you know, even though I think a mate of mine who's, you know, a big statistician in the horse racing game has told me roughly 30% of all leaders win races, you know, so like if you're able to get on something near or you know, slightly under maybe what its starting price was, and it's leading and it's led quite comfortably, you can expect to see that thing shorten as the race goes on and it stays in front. There are some variables to that. I mean, if it gets pestered in front, something comes up outside it and they race for the lead and things like that, you know, you can see the market react to that. But yeah, you need to, again, spend some ladder time watching, thinking, you know, okay, wow, you know, that's interesting that got said, or that happened and the market moved in that way. But yeah, I mean, in the end, the main reason I stopped was I found it quite laborious. It's not something that I love, is to watch racing. And the other thing is just the amounts of commission that they were charging for racing was quite big, and it sort of I've had quite a lot of success doing this, and just sort of weighing it up, I think I would have got more efficient, as in I would have made more money than what I had made in that period. Like I could have probably made maybe an extra 10 or 20 or 30% on top of what I had made if I hadn't have made as many mistakes, and I would have been able to iron those out. But in the end, spending those hours, you know, 30 hours a week doing that, and then I would want to trade a footy game in the evening or trade a cricket game as well, I noticed that it started to affect my performance in those games where I, you know, my bread and butter, where I was really making good solid coin. And it just wasn't for me. And so I gave it away after having some success in it. But I would say to people, it was only sort of 12, 18 months ago that the methods that I was mentioning were working. And as you sit and you watch and you listen, you just find little things that move the market. And it can just be the tiniest little moves that can just bang, and you can hedge up and make a little bit of cash there and get yourself a green book. And it is incredible when you just stack up $10, $20, $30 per race, how much that adds up throughout the day and then throughout the week. It's pretty incredible. So yeah, you know, then the other thing as well is just that there's a premium charge as well that comes along with Betfair, where they'll actually charge you an additional tax on winners essentially. And with horse racing, you find that you're hitting that premium charge a lot quicker with the way that it's sort of structured, my apologies. So that was another big indicator as to why it just wasn't going to be for me. So, but for people that really enjoy it, I'm sure those things would be, you know, just nothing. They wouldn't care about that sort of stuff. But for me, not being a huge racing lover, I just found it really, you know, it was, like I said, pretty laborious to really like have to sit there and listen to it and watch it. And I just didn't really care, you know. So
that is fascinating, that something seemingly so simple was effective. And I reckon you're talking about someone else that has that real passion for it and maybe knowledge could apply that, and even knowing which horses want to be leading and which don't. Yep. And obviously, like, it can be make or break in a shorter race, or especially a tight, you know, final turn.
Absolutely.
If they're out wide, if they don't get to the front before the turn, they could be in trouble. So again, like you said, with your knowledge of cricket and footy, the more you know, the more you can apply that knowledge.
Yep, absolutely. And that's a very true thing that you said about the distance of the race. And if you're good at speed maps and you can study, you know, which one, like, I had no interest in watching a replay of racing and working out which thing was going to lead. You know, I was trying to go off the punters.com.au, speed maps, which often were useful, but you know, there's also some people that knew more than me, clearly, and were able to do that study. And if that's something that would interest you, I'd be very shocked if it's still not profitable. The thing with it compared to the UK racing, where it's quite efficient, I would say, where there's a lot more turned over in play, there's a lot more eyeballs on it. Whereas with in play here in Australia for racing, there's a lot less money turned over, there's a lot less big players. It's really mostly discretional traders, hand traders that are trading against each other. There is some bots in there, and you can see them even sometimes they'll, you know, malfunction, and there's even value to pick up on a bot that can be going crazy in play. But there's a lot less eyeballs on Australian racing, and I'd be really shocked if some of those methods still aren't profitable. So if people want to get in there, you know, one big thing I would say with it is start small. You know, just start with $5-$10 trades. Like, if you're going to make mistakes at $5 and $10, you'll make them with $100 and, you know, $50 and $100 too, but 10 times the pain when it goes against you. So just start small, but get in there and have a crack on racing. I think there's definitely some money to be made and something to learn there for sure.
Very sound advice. I know we're running, getting close to the hour mark, and I value your time. And I know that I've still got a few questions. So if I can run through a few of these questions a bit rapid fire with you, so that I can make sure I've hit a lot of people's questions. You talked about the other people that are trading. So would you say there is a lot of recreational money in the pools, or are there, like, do you think there's a lot of other people like-minded to yourself? Because I imagine they'd be harder people to beat.
Depending on the sport, so tennis, I would say, is pretty solved these days. You know, you've got really big syndicates. Soccer, really solved. Cricket's a bit harder to solve, a bit harder to model. So that's one thing that people can maybe look at if they've got an interest in it. Racing, I would say, pre-off is pretty solved, but there's still money to be made in it. If you can work out, like I said, what the different participants are doing in the market and when they might primarily do it, you can ride the waves with them. But in play racing, I think, you know, it's mostly discretionary. I wouldn't call them mug money, but I'd say it's money that you can beat if you can find to be able to do the opposite. So there's definitely money to be made, and I'm living proof of that, as are friends of mine. So, yeah.
That's good to know. And again, appreciate you sharing your experiences, good and bad, with it. Do you use regular bookies too, either to place a bet because it actually, in a rare instance, beats Betfair odds, or do you even just use regular bookies to monitor odds ever?
Yeah, people that know me know that I'm a massive fanboy for Top Sport. They're the only, pretty much the only place where, you know, I can get a bet on these days. Do have a great relationship with Tristan there. He's a good friend of mine, and it's an interesting battle, you know, because obviously being good mates personally, but also, you know, he lets me bet, and I always try to look after him, and we have a great relationship in that way as well. You know, I don't bet anything scummy with them. You know, I always, you know, bet fair. It's a fair bet. They take it, and, you know, if there's an error or something like that, I'll often sort of let them know, you know, there's an error, you need to sort of fix that. It's one of my only outs, them and the tab. So, you know, it's not worth picking them off and being short-sighted and trying to get just, you know, an extra 1,000 or 2,000 there, when it's important for me to be able to place bets in, you know, and have longevity in that account. So Top Sport, tab, it's pretty much, I've got someone who will do a cash run for me in WA to the tab, but, mate, she's pretty slim pickings these days, you know, for places that'll let you have a bet. Bet Easy actually weren't too bad. It's pretty sad that they've merged now. But yeah, I still use them if there's something there, but it's primarily those couple of books that
it is always sad to see less competition. And then if you're having success, as you say, the options start diminishing. On that note, do you think Betfair is a real threat to the corporate bookies as more people get into it, get familiar, just because of the nature that they can generally get better odds than what the corporates are offering?
It should be, but it seems that people just can't quite get their head around it, or maybe the marketing's just not there from Betfair. I'm not really sure why it hasn't had a bigger uptake. I think maybe one of the things that we spoke about earlier might be the reason people will go and have a look. You know, people want to bet a week out or 5 days out or something like that. They don't understand that they need to be betting when it's liquid, and that's on the day of or in play. So it certainly should be, but I don't think the bookies would want it to, leave either, because it certainly helps them to price things up. So yeah, it should theoretically be a threat as things go on, because people, even if you're a loser on the punt, you're actually losing at a lower rate if you're getting a better price. So yeah, it should in theory, but it's been around for a long time and a lot of people still don't understand it.
Yeah, that is quite interesting. But I do get the sense it is growing, as you say. Yeah, probably still plenty of room to grow. You've shared a few resources for people. I reckon if people that are still listening and we're over the hour mark, they're pretty keen to learn. So did you have any other resources or any kind of directions you'd point people? Do people follow you on social media? I know you've got a presence on Twitter, but I've heard I haven't picked it up in this interview, but I've heard you've got a bit of a volatile personality sometimes when you're reduced to 140 characters. Not sure, but do you want to share how people can follow you and get advice off you?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm probably up to about the eighth account, I think. I don't mind telling people what I think, but sometimes that's got a few curse words, which Jack doesn't seem to like at Twitter. But yeah, my new account at the moment is Wyatt Phil, which is Wyatt Phil. Long story, but anyway, yeah, you can follow me there. I'll be happy to introduce you to a follow list that you can follow some of the people that I follow that could be helpful and beneficial, just to get a sort of feel for what they're talking about maybe in game. As for other resources, like I mentioned, Carnberry, Bet Angel, which is Peter Webb, and you'll find a bunch of other blogs and things. I would say don't buy anything. Don't buy any of those products. I think all the free stuff that they put out is perfectly fine, and it'll get you started. And if you're looking for this silver bullet, you know, do this 1, 2, 3, 4 steps and print money, you're not going to happen. So forget about it. Okay, you're in the wrong game. You need to spend time in front of the ladders. But in terms of actually understanding how to execute a trade or something like that, my DMs, I'm happy. Just send me a message. Just send me a tweet and say, hey, can you DM me or whatever. I'd be happy to help anybody at any stage, any time with actual how to, for free, for nothing. I'll spend time with you, actually teaching you how to execute a trade, no problem at all. The only thing I won't sort of obviously give to anyone is edges of mine, you know. But I'm always open to sort of give any help that I can. And one book that I would get people to read would be Mark Douglas, Trading in the Zone. It's my favorite trading book. It has nothing to do with sports trading, but everything to do about getting in the right mental headspace before you enter a session and while you're in a session. And I think it's just a great book and one that people should probably read annually.
That is great advice, I think, for life, for anyone who thinks they're trying to find a get-rich-quick scheme. You know, be skeptical, and that can often be a big downfall if you're trying to make too much money too quickly in any, you know, industry. And I appreciate so much how generous you are with your time and your knowledge. I know that you got your trade secrets, you don't want to give away your edge, but I knew that, you know, you taking this opportunity to let me interview you, that you are very forthcoming and candid with your experiences. And anyone who's listened to this, I'm sure, has appreciated that too. Can I just end with, I guess, like a mental game, I'd call it. You do it for a full-time job. You're trading Betfair across sports and racing, as you said. So when you rely on that as your income and the natural variance of it, that you're not going to make money every single day or every game, do you have any kind of advice for how you deal with that pressure of not always winning?
just accept it. Like, accept it that it, that you are, that that's going to happen, and also accept the fact that you're not robotic. You're going to have, like, I can give an example. I've been playing with this deck of cards while we've been talking, and I've mentioned that I've been back playing some online poker, and it was only, like, I've had quite good success since I've been back at it, but I had a quite a big break-even stretch in there that just sent me wild. And I've got to say, I pegged this deck of cards. I got sucked out on the river for the umpteenth time against this horrible player, and I just pegged the deck of cards and just started screaming, like, I just lost it, you know, I honestly lost it, you know. And people would think, like, well, you know, like, you're supposed to be a robot, you're supposed to be just like, you know. But I've done some work with a trading coach and a mental game coach, and Jared Tendler, and that's just on that as well. That's the other book that everybody should read. He's got two books on called Poker Mindset. Again, it's not about sports trading, but it's just all about mindset. And if you've got a basic poker knowledge, that's all you need. It just references a few spots. But I actually ended up getting so much out of his books that we did some sessions together. And they were just brilliant. But what I remember, you know, just saying, like, oh, but I'm supposed to be, you know, so zen, and I'm supposed to be in the zone, and, you know, I'm supposed to be a robot, I'm not supposed to show any emotion. That's all the shit that you read when you read, you know, be a robot. But he's like, yeah, but you're not. Like, he said, you know, like, the facts are, you're an emotional being, shit can happen in your personal life, whatever it may be. And sometimes your cup just gets so full, it just overflows, and that's it, you know. So, like, if that's happening all the time and it really affects your trading or it affects your, you know, what you're betting or whatever you're doing, that's obviously a problem. But I would say I have those blow-ups once every 6 months where I just can't handle it anymore and I just start going nuts, you know. Like, and that's just, it is what it is, and it happens to me. And I would say if it happens to you too, sort of frequently, try to get it down that's you know, less and less frequent. You know, just, it is what it is. Like, I'll take a break. Don't, you know, sort of keep trying to push through and grind through while you're all worked up. But yeah, just accept it. You know, you're not going to win all the time. And one stat I would give to people to maybe give them an understanding of just how much you should be prepared and understand that you will lose. Last time I checked, obviously hasn't been sport for a while, I haven't looked at the grass for a while, but I think I only win 49.7% of my bets, so more than half of my bets actually lose. And you know, so when you sort of think of that, you think every time I have a bet, it's more than likely that this will lose, you know. And so the more you can sort of do that, one good friend actually gave me a really good piece of advice one day, and he just said, stop caring, like, just stop worrying about it, stop caring, who gives a shit, you know, like, who gives a shit, like, stop caring about it. And some of the best advice that I ever got was just to stop caring. So yeah, that's one thing.
I'll take that advice myself, mate. I ride and die with my bets too. My hairline's receding by the day. The grays are coming out, and it's not good.
I don't mind a death ride, mate. I don't mind
all the ticker as well. Yeah, how many times you got your heart in the mouth? In, you know, in sport and racing. So, you know, being able to embrace your emotion, yeah, but also keep, I guess, calm and patient with your process. Trust the process, as they say, is great advice.
Thanks again to Lukey, and he's a really good bloke and an open book as well. If anyone's got any additional questions they want to ask you, write in the comments, and either I can get Lukey to share even more information if anyone's interested, or he gave info there of how people can get in contact with him on Twitter as well. He's generous with his knowledge. Now time for Why World Bet of the Week. Top Sport are generous with creating these markets for us even after the random AF multi got up. And of course that got up on both sides because they'd made two variations allowing you to pick either boxing leg. Well, in the end, the both boxing legs push, and everybody who got on that got paid out at 5-1. Here, this week, exciting event coming up, which I love, which is the College Football National Championship game in America. And that's going to take place Tuesday Aussie time, so 6 days from now. A couple of powerhouse teams, Georgia and Alabama, playing each other. And my tip, we're going to go on Georgia, the Bulldogs, playing $3.50 to win by 5 or more and to have 60 or less points in the match. Biggest reason I think we get an edge here and why I like Georgia to be the national champs is because this is a rematch. These two sides played just two games ago. They played for their conference championship, and Alabama won. And Alabama won big. Alabama won, I think, by 17 points and scored over 40 in that game. And I think that's etched in everyone's mind. The line for that game just a few weeks ago was Georgia minus 7.5. Well, now the line is all the way down to minus 3. And the key thing that people need to understand is when they played last time, Alabama had to win. Alabama would not make the playoffs without that win. It's an absolute kitchen sink game for Alabama. They threw everything they possibly could at Georgia. It was actually a pretty close game for three quarters, and then it just kind of blew out at the end when it got out of hand. And I feel like Alabama have shown their hand now, where I think Georgia can go to another gear. I don't think that the big line shift is justified. I think Georgia still are the stronger unit, especially a really strong defense that I see no way they're going to give up, north of 40 this time around. And that's also why I like the under 60.5, which the total for this game is 52. But I'm getting that extra wiggle room as well for a combined 60 or less to get us that price of $3.50. So jump on that if you have any interest in the college football. It's always a massive event, and that's going to take place, as I said, next week. Good luck with that one. Good luck with any other punts you have this weekend. In fact, I want to shout out No Morals, which is our weekly racing show that we brought out during the spring. The Magic Millions Carnival is upon us at the Gold Coast, and there is going to be a show. Stay tuned. It's either going to be tomorrow night, so Thursday, or possibly Friday, and you will see that on the Tripod Facebook page. It's a Facebook video show, short racing preview show with about 10-15 minutes. Benny Scarf, Jason Campbell, picking a few winners. They did really well in the spring, so they'll be telling you what they like for the upcoming Gold Coast meet. Take care, guys, and I'll see you next week. Leggo!